possible in part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sport shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff. Today's programming is made possible in part by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, offering ground and whole bean coffee purchased from farmers using internationally recognized fair trade standards.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. On the program today, we're going to take a look at religious freedom and international law. Our guest is Father Robert Drynan, a professor of law at Georgetown University. His latest book is Can God and Caesar Coexist? Balancing Religious Freedom and International Law. In this book, Father Drynan examines the state of religious freedom throughout the world. He looks at religious freedom in the U.S., in Europe, in China, in the Muslim world, and in the world's Jewish community. He also devotes chapters to dissent, government repression of religion, and religious freedom and issues of gender and sexuality. Has international law done enough to protect religious freedom? How does one reach international consensus on the issue? Those are a couple of the questions we'll take up this afternoon. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion today with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Robert Drynan is a Jesuit priest. He is a professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center. He's also been a visiting professor at four American universities and dean of the Boston College Law School. He served five terms in Congress as a representative from Massachusetts. He is the author of many books and is the recipient of many awards. He was most recently honored in 2003 by the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. The Institute awarded him the Freedom of Worship Medal. His new book, Can God and Caesar Coexist?, is published by Yale. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Father Drynan, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you very much to be on your station.
Oh, my pleasure. You know, when I came to this book, I thought the ability to practice religion without discrimination or persecution and freedom from religion, these are part of our right to religious freedom. Now, those are this American's first thoughts on the issue. You know, other Americans will argue for school prayer. Would you offer us some sense of what comprises religious freedom here and how it differs in other parts of the world?
Well, I think we have to begin with the insertion in international law of the term conscience. This is entirely new. And in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 48 and in some dozen covenants on human rights, the term conscience now is a part of world law, that the government has to respect the demands of conscience. They must be given attention. And that's entirely new. And we don't know exactly what freedom of religion was going to develop into, but it's now universal law from the Universal Declaration. Everybody has the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion. And it includes freedom to change his religion or belief and freedom to manifest his religion. So it's very broad. And in the United States, we like to think that we have the perfect solution of it, but that may not be necessarily so, at least not in the global sense.
Yeah. Well, I mentioned that conflict right there at the beginning, you know, separation of state and church, and you know, that's something that we hold near and dear, although, you know, there are Americans who will argue for school prayer, so there's conflict here.
There really is, and there's been some consensus by the Supreme Court. But people would argue that it's in violation of world law, which guarantees a broader freedom of religion. The real problem, of course, is with the Muslim world, 48 Islamic nations, 1.2 billion Muslims, every fifth human being. And they have a somewhat different. They think that the Quran should dominate, and much of their law, or some of their law in these countries, is derived directly from the Quran or from Sharia, the binding law. That obviously complicates the picture.
Yeah. Well, and also in a nation like Ireland, we have Catholicism as the country's religion in the Constitution.
One of the big issues that mankind has to confront sometimes is whether or not a government can impose one religion. In all the Muslim countries, or most of them, they would say that our Muslim religion is a part of the law of this country, even if it violates the law or the rights of Christians. China is the prime example. They don't want any foreign religions there at all, and they quite literally make it almost impossible for Christians to exist.
Yeah. Well, religion has offered many people great comfort among its contributions, but it has also been for many calamitous.
And that's the story of history. And the present Holy Father has asked the apologies, has given apologies to the world for over 80 things that the Catholic Church has done through the centuries, the Crusades, the Inquisition, the persecution of the Jews. And I think a new era is here, and the Catholic Church recognized that in 1965 in the Declaration on Religious Freedom of Vatican II. It changed everything, and the Catholic Church is not going back into all of those things, and many Protestant nations have recognized that. So we're at a new peak, but the United Nations has put through covenants or treaties on all the big topics like freedom of the press and freedom of assembly, but they've never reached a covenant on religious freedom. There's a mere declaration agreed to in 1981. If we move forward and had a covenant, that would mean that we would have some world body supervising religious freedom around the world. That is the ideal. I don't know how soon we're going to get it.
Yeah. That's a thorny kind of thing to think about, though, in terms of what would guide this body and who would sit on the body in judgment.
There's big questions to decide, but I think that the world is moving towards that, recognizing that in the past, with no supervision at the international level of religions, a lot of them have gone and persecuted people. And the example of the Jews, of course, is paramount, that they were literally persecuted for centuries in a Christian society. And after the Holocaust, we want to move out of that. Can we get some world consensus? We've got it on other things, many things. And can we get it on religion? And the thrust of the book is that, yes, that's the next step.
Hmm. In the book, you write, respect for religious freedom seems to be instinctual, deep and powerful, but it has not yet flowered and matured like the right to freedom of the press or speech. Why not?
Well, I wish I knew. It's very complicated, and religion is obviously different. And Catholics would say that faith comes to us not by any virtue of our own, but by the will of God. And we can accept faith and take it as a grace from God. So it's not predictable. Furthermore, going to the Muslim world again, they say that all of this derives from the Prophet and that it is infallible and unchangeable. And they say, the Muslims, that no one can leave his religion. And they say somehow that's in the Quran. So these are very complicated things. But in fairness to humanity, we've never thought about these things until 1948. Then we recognized, almost for the first time, that religion can be very divisive and corrosive and damaging to all of humanity.
Yeah. Do you think a strict separation of church and state is possible? You mentioned the Muslim nations of the world. It would seem that that would be unlikely.
Well, it really would be unlikely, in that a strict separation depends upon your meaning of that. And in the United States, we have what I call a symbiosis of religion and government, that two substances living together who need each other and who get along in harmony and peace. We have a unique situation in America. We're only 4% of the world, and we tend to extrapolate this and impose this on the rest of the world. Europe has a Christian culture. Many of those states there still establish the Christian religion in many ways. So I don't think that we can talk about one solution for the whole world. China and India, once again, very different. But the United Nations now have been striving, and they say that freedom of conscience is the thing, and that we want to let people to follow their conscience. And some people would say that the conscience of an individual is the voice of God.
Hmm. If a strict separation of church and state was possible, would it be desirable?
Well, once again, what is strict separation? That in every country of the world, you have a religious base. Is it monogamous marriage? And do they protect children? They certainly protect religious freedom and the right to have churches or mosques. What do we mean by strict separation? Well, once again, we simplify the thing by saying, oh, in the United States, we keep religion out of the public schools. But even in the United States, or especially in the United States, there's thousands of aids to religion, tax exemption, and the right to hold vast properties, and the right to proselytize, all types of things.
Yeah. Well, now, given the sovereignty of nations, what can the international community do?
Well, that's a very good question. That the sovereignty of nations has been eroded by agreement of the whole world. 191 nations now are members of the UN, and by Articles 55 and 56 of the UN Charter, all these nations agree to erode their sovereignty, if you will. They give up the right to make war unless the Security Council clears it. And they said that we will live up to all of the obligations under the UN Charter and also now under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So it's not absolute sovereignty. That's been eroded. These nations now are part of a whole unit, which is humanity.
Mm. The UN Declaration on Religious Freedom, what kinds of issues does it address, and how is it less powerful than a covenant or a treaty?
Well, it addresses many issues, and the entire covenant is an appendix of, in my book, Can God and Caesar Coexist? It says, first of all, that the government has to recognize the dictates of conscience and freedom of thought and freedom of religion. Then it begins to spell those things out. It's not required to give tax exemption, but they can't tax churches out of existence. They have to be benign, if you will, to churches and to religious congregations. And it sets up a whole series of rights that are new in the history of the world. Well, if it became a covenant, that would mean that there'd be a supervising body somewhere that would require nations who belong to the covenant to report on what they have done for religious freedom. This would be equivalent to the six UN bodies that now supervise and monitor the carrying out of the other treaties on the rights of women and children, etc. It would be a salutary thing. It would be very complicated, though, as you're suggesting, and everybody admits that. What should a world body do when, for example, Saudi Arabia does not allow women to vote or to hold office?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a great big issue right there, women's rights, suffrage.
And also the rights of gays. That
okay.
The
mm-hmm.
European Court of Human Rights was set up in 1953, and that it recently said that the English Navy could not keep out gays or throw out gays from the military. Two sensational decisions. And the United States Supreme Court in Lawrence v. Texas last year has said that Texas cannot enforce their statute against sodomy among males. So this whole issue of the rights of gays is evolving. And likewise, other issues are evolving in world law. People are sensitive to this, particularly the rights of women. And that some women, understandably, would say that the Catholic Church or other religious units has been unfair to women. Question, would this world body eventually have to say that women have a right to be ordained because mm-hmm. they are women, and that no religious body like the Catholic Church could say that we will only ordain men? These are the multiple questions that have to face us. No one pretends they're easy. But the United Nations says that these are the central issues of involving human rights, and we want to work towards a resolution.
Yeah. Do you see this body being with coming within the UN then?
Oh, yeah, I would think so, because the UN put out the declaration, and that it might have some variation, but these six monitoring groups under the supervision of the United Nations are having an effect. For example, every nation except the United States now has ratified the Covenant on the Rights of the Child. There's a supervisory body that puts out issues for the nations, and the nations say, we have now an obligation. It's remarkable what nations have done pursuant to the Covenant to enhance and enlarge the rights of children.
Hmm. Do we need a body within the UN of religious diplomats?
Well, they almost did that, but then they backed away because they didn't have the votes. And all during the 60s and 70s, people are saying, well, we have to do something about this. And eventually, in 1981, all the nations got together. They didn't have the votes to create a covenant that would be binding, but they put forth this Declaration on Human Freedom, summarizing everything that had gone before, particularly the immensely important document from Vatican II in 1965. That's the best that we have since 1981. Many people around the world, jurists and human rights academics and activists, have said we have to get something that is enforceable. We may or may not move to that next step, but the whole world, as noted in my book, wants something more, both to give religious freedom and also, very bluntly, to curb some of the churches.
Yeah. There was a couple of times in history a Parliament of World Religions. This was interesting reading this. You touch on this in the book. And in 1993, the Parliament met in Chicago and developed a declaration toward a global ethic.
No, I was there in Chicago in 1993. It was fantastic. These religious leaders from all over the world, and they were updating that something had occurred also in Chicago a century before. It's an immensely important document. People from all of the religions, including the Muslims, they want religion to be what religion should be, namely a religion of peace. And we love other people. We don't make war against them. We don't make alliances with secular entities like nations and go and persecute other people. We like to think all of that is just a bad memory going through the centuries, and this is an entirely new era.
Yeah. Well, here again, this Parliament of World Religions gets us back to talking about the idea of conscience and human dignity as guiding our thinking about religious freedom.
Well, that the notion of conscience, which is in the documents now for the first time in history, that's the explosive one. If a person says that I am compelled in conscience to do this or believe this, the world now says we respect conscience. It agrees with Martin Luther and Cardinal Newman, both of whom said that the voice of conscience is the voice of God. How is this going to play out? The government of China forbids many people from having a second child, and that they do this in the name of overpopulation. Suppose these people insist that God is telling me, I am convinced by my conscience that I have to have a second or a third child. Is there some world order that would say to China, you have to respect that voice of conscience?
Hmm.
Large issues.
Yeah. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Robert Drynan, our guest today. He's the author of his latest book is Can God and Caesar Coexist, Balancing Religious Freedom and International Law? My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest this afternoon is a professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center. He has also served five terms in Congress as a representative from Massachusetts. Can God and Caesar Coexist? Published by Yale. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. What compromises consensus? When we use these words, what are we talking about? Are we talking about a majority opinion, a majority of the world's nations coming together and
Well, that's one of the factors. Can there be a consensus as to the precise meaning of religious freedom around the world? We've moved towards that in remarkable ways over the last 20 years. But there are still terrible problems. For example, what should the nations do about religiously based schools? One solution is that of China. We don't allow private schools or religious schools at all. Just blank no. I think that people would be opposed to that. The second solution would be what Europe does, that we allow church-led schools and they get financing up to 90% of what the public schools get. Likewise, in Germany, people take religion, the Catholic or the Lutheran religion. Well, that's the second compromise. And the third compromise is what we do in the United States. We allow private schools, but they don't get any substantial funding. And that has been affirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court several times, that religiously based schools of less than collegiate rank do not get any public funding, except maybe bus rides. Those are the three options. Some people in the United States would say, this is charging me for my religious convictions. I have to spend $8,000 a year on tuition to send my kids to Catholic schools, and that's an unfair burden. That argument has not carried weight yet in the courts, but it's very powerful.
Yeah. You know, going back to the idea of conscience, there are people who take very seriously the commandment to go forth, spread the word. And, you know, and if where they're going forth, they meet with opposition, people of good conscience saying no.
This is one of the essential questions involved, and the Mormons are missionaries by nature, and they send out thousands of young people every year to all types of countries. They've never been able to send missionaries to China. Should they, under world law, be allowed to do that? And one has to admire the Mormons that they have such ingenuity. They go to all of Europe and Africa and Latin America. The Catholics have always, and the Protestants have always had missionaries, and they went in large numbers to China, and that is now not possible. Should there be some world understanding that missionaries who are following Christ and his directive to radiate the religion, should they have some rights to go and evangelize?
Yeah, because conscience, I can be of, you know, I can hold things near and dear in my conscience and act in a certain way, and you know, you might have a different spirit guiding you.
Well, we agree to that, and everything is different, and we stand in awe, really, of the conscience of a person when that individual said that God himself is telling me this. Now, we put some curbs on the Christian Scientists. There was a famous case in Massachusetts where this wonderful religious couple allowed their child of 12 to die from a disease that was curable. And they were sentenced for a crime, but not imprisoned. And that law in Massachusetts was repealed. But that's the law in, say, 20 or 30 states now under pressure from the Christian side. This is what we believe. You have to respect that. That's the way Mary Baker Eddy interpreted the scriptures. But there's some point when the civil law has to say no.
Let's talk with a listener. Caller in Savoy, line one. Hi.
Hi. I don't have any children, and I don't send any children to school. And I don't complain about my property taxes or my income taxes going to funding a public school. But I wonder what it is that says that people who do have kids and want to send them to a religious school, why their complaints of, you know, well, I have to pay $8,000 or whatever a year for tuition for my kids, and I want my tax dollars to go to that in the form of vouchers or whatever. Why is, you know, I guess I could turn around and say, well, I would like all of my property taxes that I don't use for schools to be refunded to me, but I don't, because I feel as a good, you know, member of this community that I would like the people around me in this community to have, you know, because I would like to support them to have their children educated. I guess I just don't see where, you know, why that has any weight.
All right, sir, it's a very, very good question. Article 18 of the Universal Declaration of Independence says that the law, the government has to have respect for parents to ensure that they get the religious or moral education of their children in conformity with their own convictions and their conscience. This is an element that we have to respect people who differ, and that you make the objection that has been maintained in American courts, but in the world, lots of people think differently, and that it's the idea of their conscience. We may say, well, that's a luxury, but that's not a luxury for them. And that Mormons have that. There's hardly any Mormon kids who go to, some go to the public schools, but they get training all the time. The Seventh-day Adventists insist that all their children go to an Adventist school. They're different. And that we may say, well, that's getting government funds. And that's the great principle of Thomas Jefferson. Sir, you make a very good statement and question, and the whole world is agonizing over that question right now.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for your call this afternoon. Other questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm going to reintroduce our guest this afternoon. Then we're going to pause for about 4 seconds so our engineers can do some work at our transmitter. So our guest this afternoon is Robert Drinan. He is a professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center. He's also been a visiting professor at four American universities and dean of the Boston College Law School. He served 5 terms in Congress as a representative from Massachusetts. He's the author of many books. His latest is Can God and Caesar Coexist? Balancing Religious Freedom and International Law. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. And let's pause here now so our engineers can get that work accomplished at the transmitter. We'll pause here for about 4 seconds. And I don't even think that was 4 seconds. That's very good. We're back on the air with Robert Drinan. Let's talk about this idea of world court. At this point in our history here in the United States, this would be quite contentious, would it not?
Yes, I think it would be. And that, incidentally, in our Constitution, Article 6 says that there should never be any religious requirement for an office, a public office. So we said that way back in 1789, that you can't discriminate against Christians or Protestants or anybody. No religious test shall ever be used. And that's a part of world law now, that you have to hire a person if he's competent, despite his religion or his absence of religion. Now, I admit in the book that these are new concepts, and that after we saw the Holocaust, people were killed, 6 million, just because of their religion, and we said that can never happen again, and we want to prevent it in every way. We had Nuremberg, and we punished certain Germans and Japanese for their crimes, and that we're so terrified of that could that happen again? So that the whole UN machinery, and now this Declaration on Religious Freedom, is designed to prevent that horrible thing from ever happening.
Yeah. The UN Declaration, does it have any teeth? Does it have any clout?
No, I wouldn't say that, ma'am. The Universal Declaration was adopted by 48 states in 1948, and it is now what the lawyers call customary international law. That means it's binding on every nation, and it may even be higher than customary international law. It may be just cogent, binding. It has the impact of a moral statement agreed to by everybody, and that there's 2 or 3 books came out recently on what the Universal Declaration has done around the world. It contains economic rights, too, the right to food and to nourishment and health. That's not observed totally, but it's observed much more than it was in the world in 1948.
Mm. The non-governmental organizations working in the world today, they are working on many issues that I suppose you could say are connected to conscience and human dignity.
Well, they are. In fact, it was the NGOs that helped to write the Declaration on Religious Freedom, and they introduced these elements, particularly the Quakers and the Friends and the unpopular or the small religious groups like the Quakers. The Quakers particularly have been saying, we are conscientious objectors, And they and many others work to insert in the Declaration on Human Rights the rights of COs. They didn't quite succeed saying that they can't be required. They are still required in world law to do alternative service. But the rights of those opposed to war are more recognized now than any time in history.
Hmm. You say in this book, in closing the book, one of the things that you say is that you seem to think that envision religious liberty growing and becoming a right, and this is how you put it, a right more important than many of the others recognized by the human race since the end of World War II.
Well, I think that's not me saying it exactly. That's what the world is saying.
Hmm.
And that they say in these documents that the very essence of a person is his religious outlook on human existence. And that is entitled to profound respect by the whole world. That's his essence. And if he comes as a Hindu to some worldview, that should be respected. He shouldn't be derided for it. And that he's entitled to the respect of everyone around him, even though they're difficult or dissenting views. This is an amazing thing, once again attributable in part to the Holocaust. They were killed simply because they're different, they're Jews. And that's a terrible thing to allow any government to even think that way. Consequently, we view people because of their beliefs or their agnosticism.
Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Champaign, line one. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Well, let's come back to that that line. Let's go next to a listener in Urbana, line two. Hi.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that I believe it's in the current issue of Ms. Magazine. There's a terrific article called Fighting Words for a Secular America by Robin Morgan.
What paper is that, sir?
Ms. Magazine.
Oh, all right. I'll get it. I'm interested.
Well, this is, it's really something. She put together quotes from Thomas Paine, Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, all the founders, and she points out stuff like the fact that the Declaration of Independence didn't contain anything about the word, didn't contain the word religion. And in fact, that we were kind of unique, especially as against Europe, where there was the idea of divine rule.
Well, sir,
we thought that the power derived from ordinary people.
Well, sir, I'm saying the same thing in my book, and that we don't want a totally secularistic society in the pejorative sense, but that religions have been too much grabbing through the centuries the power of the government. And the Catholic Church did that, and now the Catholic Church has backed away. We have no right to demand that the government support religion. Religion has to support itself. And I agree with Jefferson and all those people. And in America, we have a unique distillation, a unique arrangement, and the churches are on their own. But we respect the churches, and we need some of their teachings so that we can be a virtuous people. I won't say that the United States has found the best formula in the world. After all, we're virtually all Christians here. It's much more complicated for nations that have not had that background.
Yeah, I just want to point out that something else mentioned in this article, and I think this woman would be a great interviewee for Celeste, but that in the Treaty of Tripoli, George Washington and John Adams were apparently both involved in writing that. It specifically claimed that the government of the United States of America is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion.
That's right.
And, you know, well, anyway, I just thought I'd point that out.
So that fits into my thesis in the book, that no religion has the right to say, this is a government that favors Catholicism. That should not be done. It's bad for the state. It's bad for the church.
Okay, let's talk
about it. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, and I'll look for that article, and maybe we'll indeed invite the writer of that particular article onto the program. Okay, now let's go back to line one, and I understand that we have our caller in Champaign all lined up now. Line one, go ahead.
Hi, sorry, I got cut off. Maybe you've already discussed this, and I'm coming in late. You said, I'd just like to know what it is to be secular in the pejorative sense. And also then, I don't know if you've discussed those who would like to have their right not to be religious protected, that they don't believe in God. They found the whole concept foreign and strange and psychotic. You know, or they may have different concepts of what God is, or they may have different concepts of virtue or what, how to be virtuous.
No, ma'am, all of that is protected in the new international law, that they have freedom of thought and freedom of conscience and freedom of religion. It's all there, the triad, the freedom of thought, conscience, and religion, so that the non-believers may not be discriminated against in any way.
Right, but what is it that you want to change? That if you think that the society is secular in a pejorative sense...
Well, let's take China. I think that they say we are pushing for anything that is good for China, and we don't care about the freedom of conscience of other people. And granted, the situation is very serious. They say only one child to every couple, and if you have a second child, there's penalties involved. Well, I think that would be secular. They don't care about the religious aspirations of the people or what is the cultural tradition of that country.
And what if that person is or is not religious and they would like to have some information about abortion or morning after pills?
No, I think that's a good question. And the Universal Declaration on Religious Freedom says that the government can't follow one religion, it can't support one religion, or on the other hand, it can't be militantly atheistic or agnostic. It has to say that religious freedom goes to all people, and if they are not religious, they have freedom of thought and freedom of conscience. It's the broadest possible formula.
Mm-hmm. And are you discussing in any way the situation in the United States?
Well, I have a chapter, actually, in the book, thank you for asking that, where I describe the evolution, and that I'm not saying that we have the ideal situation now, but at least we have one that has been thought out by the Congress, by the legislature, and by the Supreme Court. Some people are dissatisfied, and that conscientious objectors and Seventh-day Adventists and other people say we don't have adequate liberty for the way our conscience operates.
And, what do you think about what's going on in France, for example, with people being told they're not allowed to wear veils or speak turbans?
Well, ma'am, I'm glad that you brought that up, because Turkey last year forbade a woman from wearing the veil when she was going to a university. Turkey is overwhelmingly Muslim, but they become secular. And that she was required to transfer to Austria to finish her medical studies. And the European Court rather recently sustained Turkey, and that as a secular state, they have the right to ban the headdress. I think that decision was wrong. I think we should maximize the religious freedom. But Turkey said that this is a secular state. This woman is proselytizing by wearing the veil. She's seeking to make the Muslim religion a part of life here, and we don't want that. That's a hard question. And France, as you know, by legislation, has said that no woman may wear the veil. And Germany may be doing something like that. Here is a clash of civilizations, if you will. And that the Muslims are new in Western culture. But I think this is a vivid example where the government would say, well, we allow that. That's something very important to this woman.
You mean the U.S. government?
Well, the U.S. does allow it. And in fact, the Bush administration is on the side of a young girl in Oklahoma who was told by the public school authorities not to wear the veil, and that the Justice Department said that's a part of her right and in religious freedom.
Well, what about a president who thinks that the only way to help people that have drug problems is to use some kind of faith-based initiative?
Well, I know that's a whole other question, and that has not been completely tested in the courts. And I have my feelings against that. All of the religious groups are being used, like the Salvation Army and Catholic Charities, and that they do a vast amount of good. But when the government seemingly favors church-related or religiously affiliated groups, I'm opposed to that.
But you haven't really said yet what you think is pejoratively secular.
Well, what I meant is China and pejoratively is that they disfavor religion. This is a secular country. Maybe we could apply that to Turkey. And they say that this is secular in the pejorative sense. We don't want the government to encourage or allow Muslims to do anything.
Right. Well, what about virtue then? I mean, I think people have various views of what virtuous means or how to be virtuous. You could be an atheist philosopher and have some ideas about practices that would lead to virtue.
Well, you're quite right. And in the federal government here, we promote, every government promotes virtue. And that I think that there's no difficulty about that. We punish crimes, and we tell children in school that they can't cheat, and there's a penalty for that. No one is opposed to that central core of values we have in this country. Do they come from religion? Some, ultimately. But the government has to say that we want a virtuous people and that we want to train up wonderful people who are learned and who are good citizens. Now, can they use religious values? Well, they do. Every country uses the religious values. Can they discriminate against people who don't have those religious values? And the answer is no, in America and more in world religious freedom.
And one of the concerns I have, I'm not sure if I can articulate it, but has to do with a growing sense that everyone must be saved and believe that Jesus Christ is who is saving them or what is saving them.
Well, ma'am, I don't have that. And if somebody puts that into the government, I think that's a total aberration. And that every president takes an oath to support the Constitution, but that if he smuggles in religion and is aiding and abetting religion, that's totally contrary to all our traditions.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. We have a couple minutes left with our guest this afternoon, Robert Drynan, author of Can God and Caesar Coexist? Balancing Religious Freedom and International Law. If we were to have a covenant on religious freedom, how would we go about, other than handing down rulings, or how would we, what kind of enforcement power?
Well, the usual process is that every country who's a signatory, this is on the six other covenants, periodically, every 3 or 4 years, is required to make a report to the UN court or commission on how they have complied, for example, with the covenant on torture. And the world body issues a statement with various suggestions, and a body of law develops as to what is good for the child or contrary to the rights of the child. That would happen on religious freedom. Would there be a penalty? Well, at this stage, there's only the penalty of world opinion. Mm. And if, for example, this court or covenant were created, they would say harsh things about China and about the Sudan and the toughest cases, and that world opinion would be influenced. Would other countries listen to this, and would it be bad for Sudan? It certainly would. That world trade would be inhibited and diminished. So we're looking to the recognition that people need for their own nation. We now have a new rating out every year on the level of corruption in countries, and that if a country is very low on that, that world business is not going to go there. Is very, very detrimental to the reputation and future of that country. Would we eventually get to the point that somebody will be penalized and tried for a violation of this? Well, that's far down the line. But right now, we want the mobilization of shame against these things that are indefensible in the Sudan.
Yeah. Do you think it's likely to happen?
Right now, no. Right now, the people are saying, well, let's just work with religious freedom and let public opinion. The NGOs, however, are working very hard on this. And in a chapter on the book, in the book I have something that the Congress did 5 years ago. They created a new entity within the State Department to monitor the state of religious freedom around the world. And periodically, this entity puts out warnings and notes the five or more countries that are the worst on religious freedom. This has some educational impact. They put out an annual report, and it's online all around the world, and nations know that they have been criticized by this body. Furthermore, more recently, just last month, the Congress created a new entity in the State Department to monitor anti-Semitism around the world. And people thought that maybe this is a good idea. Anti-Semitism just keeps coming back. Anything that we can do to explore it and to condemn it is good in the world.
There we'll leave it. Father Drinan, thank you very much for joining us this
thank
afternoon.
Thank you. You run a good show.
thank you for that compliment. Robert Drinan has been our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. His latest book, Can God and Caesar Coexist? Balancing Religious Freedom and International Law. The book is published by Yale University Press. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Father is right, Celeste. You do run a good show.
Oh, thank you, Todd.
From the Chicago Board of Trade. Let's take a look at what happened on this last trading week, or last trading day, rather, of the week. At the board in the wheat pit, futures finished the day lower. December contract down 5.75 cents today at 3.26 on the high, the low at 3.14, and a settlement price at 5.75 lower was at 3.16 1/2. The March contract 3.36 high, low at 3.25 1/4, settlement price at 3.28 1/2 down 5 cents. In May futures, 3.40 1/2 the high, the low at 3.30 1/2, and a settlement price at 3.34 1/2. They were down 4 cents. July contract in the wheat pit 3.42 1/2 for the day. On the high, the low at 3.34 1/2, a settlement price at 3.37 down 3 1/2, and the September contract down 3.47 1/2, the high, the low at 3.41, settlement price at 3.43 1/2. They were off 3.5 cents for the day. Despite those lower trades for the day, the wheat finished the weekly trade up 8 cents in the December contract and 11 cents in the July contract. In the corn pit, futures were narrowly mixed for the week, or narrowly higher for the week, settling 0.5 cent higher in the December and July futures, up 1.25. That, of course, Friday trade to Friday trade on the settlement prices. Now, here are the settlement prices for today's trade. 207.5 the high in the December contract for the corn pit, the low at 201.5, a settlement price at 202 1/2. They were off 3.75 cents today. March futures down 4.25, 218 the high, the low at 212 1/4, and a settlement price at 213. In the May contract, a 225.5 high, low at 220, settled 220 1/2. They were off 4.25 for the day. And July futures, 237.75 and the high, the low at 233.5. A settlement price at 234.25. They were down 3 cents. December futures, 245.75 high, low at 241.5. Settlement price there at 242.75, down 2.5 cents for the day. December oat futures up 0.5 cent, as well as the March contract up 0.5 too. Settlement price at 142.75 and 149.5. respectively, for the December and March oat contracts. From the soy complex now, November beans, 5.32 1/2 the high, low at 5.23 3/4, settlement price at 5.27 1/2. They were down 2 cents. January futures had a trading range 5.37 to 5.28 with a settlement price of 5.33 1/2. They were off 2, and the March contract off 2 as well, 5.43 1/2 the high, the low at 5.35 1/4, settled at 5.40 1/4. Once again, that March contract down 2 cents. May futures off 2, 5.50 1/2 the high, the low at 5.43, settled at 5.46 1/2. July futures, the first one that didn't make the down 2 for the settlement price for the day, were off 1.75, 5.57 1/2 the high, the low at 5.49 1/2, settlement price about halfway in between that at 5.54 1/4, down 1.75 for the day for the July soybeans. And next year's August contract, 5.55 the high, the low, and the settlement price, just one trade there today, down 3 cents for the August beans. Bean meal December contract, 155.50 the high, the low at 153.30. The bean meal product settled at 153.90, down 150, and the January contract was off $1.30 at 155.60 with a high of 157.20 and a low at 154.80. December bean oil futures, 21.65 the high for the day, the low at 21.26, a settlement price at $21.50. They were off, or rather up a penny for the day, and the January contract in the bean oil down 3 cents at 21.58 with a high of 21.82 and a low at $21.36 a pound. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. Lean hogs finished higher today, while cattle mostly lower. November feeder cattle 111.57 and a half, the high 108.90, the low 109.20, the settlement that down 225. January 108.42 and a half, the high 105.42 and a half, the low 105.52 and a half, the settlement that down 290. March feeders 104.05, the high, the low 101.32 and a half, the settlement 101.80, that down 252 and a half. October live cattle 88.20, the high 84.05, the low, the settlement 87.85, that up 107 and a half. December 86.50, the high 83.30, the low 84.47 and a half, the settlement that down 177 and a half. December lean hog 67.60, the high 66.10, the low 67.45, the settlement that up 110. February 67.30, the high 65.85, the low 67.20, the settlement that up 132 and a half. April lean hog 64.90, the high 63.65, the low 64.75, the settlement that up 90. And May lean hog 65.25, the high 63.80, the low, finishing at 65.22 and a half. And the change there up 87 and a half. February pork bellies 96.80, the high 94.50, the low 94.80, the settlement that up 7.5 cents. The Dow up 4 points at 10,009. The Nasdaq down 5 at 1971, and the S&P 500 off a fraction at 1127.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
James Marcus from San Antonio, Texas writes, "Dear Dr. Science, I have a friend in Australia who asked if the phases of the moon are apparently the same to an observer in that country as opposed to the USA. I said, yes. Was I correct?"
Yes, you were correct that the moon is apparently the same size in Australia as it is here, though the similarity is just in appearance. Actually, the Australians can't see the moon at all due to the fact that they occupy the bottom half of the globe, and the moon only spins around the top or normal half of our planet. But in order to make Australians feel less weird and left out, Theodore Roosevelt authorized the construction of a fake moon for the Southern Hemisphere, made out of plaster of Paris and chicken wire. It floats a few thousand feet above the center of the Australian outback, and an Aussie who's had one too many Fosters, well, he can't tell the difference.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath. To order the Dr. Science